Frank here, he's got his own billiard room.
Yes, what do you call it, Kramer?
The billiard room.
No.
The name.
The billiard? Not billiards. It was. Come on, Rudy. What? Come on. We call it the.
The place to be.
The place to be, yes.
It's the place to be. Then I shall be there.
Hello, Place to Be fans. This is Justin Rosero here with our latest installment of the Place to Be podcast. And with me, as always, is my partner in crime, my PIC, Scott Criscola. How you doing, Scotty?
Good evening, sir. Good to see you as always and hear you. Actually, I don't really see you. I hear you. What's going on?
Not too much. I am ready to get into some wrestling talk. We're going to start off our pay-per-view classic review series with, of course, the granddaddy of them all. WrestleMania 1, you ready to get into this or what?
I'll tell you something. It is the bread and butter with which you and I have created our cyberspace reputations. For those who are familiar with us, and we have a lot of – and first of all, for the first couple that we posted, first couple of podcasts, again, thank you to the fans who have been listening so far. Keep listening. And for those that are new, welcome again. And the reason – a little background on this before we get started. When we first put our when let's go back to when we first met. I'm not going to go through this long diatribe, but one of the first things we did online was write reviews for every WWE pay-per-view. We're both obviously big wrestling fans. WWE is our bread and butter. It's the we're both Northeasterners, so it's the promotion we grew up with. And it got it's gotten a lot of play. A lot of websites have posted them. A lot of blogs. Graham Cawthon's History of WWE.com has posted them. So we thought it would be kind of cool to, kind of put it in an audio form and give you, the listener, a chance to not only listen to our comments and listen to the way we can recap, but please, you have the email address right there, placetobepodcast@gmail.com, and give us your comments about all the shows we do. If you have any questions, if you have a correction, we get corrections all the time on our written reviews from our loyal and very, very smart readers about some corrections. So please, we're not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. We're probably, again, and we've said this before, we're probably two of the most unassuming wrestling fans in terms of we're not perfectionists. We're not, we like our stuff to be good, but we're not those kind of people that stick our nose up in the air and think we're the, everything we do and say is perfect.
Even though it is.
Well, that's true, but, we'll just nod and move on. But the other thing is, we're not one of those kind of – we're going to say it right now because we're going to do plenty of these over time. Obviously, we're coming up on 35 years worth of – or not 35, 25 years worth of pay-per-views. We're never going to tell you – unless it's something really blatant, we're never going to tell you to watch something or definitely not watch something. It's all your opinion. We just tell you what we think of it, and maybe it'll sway you to either tell us, these guys are right, the show does suck, or these guys are wrong, the show's really good. That's what we want to do. We want you to open up your mind to something and let us know, wow, you guys are right, or wow, you guys are idiots, one or the other. And it's all in good fun. So we obviously begin at the beginning.
It's very profound.
It is. I know. Thank you. I want everyone to get to feel the moment. What's funny about this is my wonderful partner was a mere 5 years old.
Not even. I was four. A little over four, 4 years old.
That's right. 4 years old because you didn't turn five until that December. I was 11.
27.
I was – no, that was the Aaron Burr, Alexander Hamilton duel.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
Which was on pay-per-view as well for 10 shekels. But,
yes.
Just the folks, you're going to get plenty of old jokes. So please, email good old jokes because I giggle at all of them. Obviously, a little history lesson to begin. The WWWF, the Worldwide Wrestling Federation, started in 1963 by Vince McMahon Sr., obviously Big Vince's father, They broke off from the National Wrestling Alliance because there was a dispute between whether Lou Thesz or Buddy Rogers was the NWA World Heavyweight Champion. So Vince Sr. and Toots Mont decided to create their own promotion. Thus, the Worldwide Wrestling Federation was born in 1963. I want to ask you something, though, quickly. You know, Vern Gagne got all pissed off in the 80s when Vince Jr., as we're around this time of the first WrestleMania, picking all the talent and all this other stuff, breaking off, doing his own thing. Meanwhile, he got upset in the 50s because he was never considered NWA World Champion. So he broke off, made his own promotion, and made himself champion. I never understood that. Why he pissed and moaned in the 80s about Vince doing it. Meanwhile, he did it to the NWA before Vince Sr. even did it. I just never understood that.
I guess during the time that he broke off, though, I think it was a little more understanding with the territories where you kind of knew these are your guys, this is your area, you don't go into anyone else's other area. So maybe he felt that he played by those rules, but Vince didn't. The other thing I want to say is I picture Toots Mont looking like you for some reason. I can see you being a Toots.
That's right, I am a Toots. And we used to sit at Toots Shores in Manhattan with whiskey and cigars and signing contracts for Bobo Brazil and Edouard Compatier.
Sounds about right.
Oh, jeez, that's funny. Oh, man. And I could see you, ripping tickets underneath the tent at the Warwick Musical Theater.
So, oh, yes, if only it was still open.
Yes. We'll get to all these little tidbits as we get through time. But, so, you know, Vince Sr., just a little history lesson to set yourself up here for those that are new to the new fans. The WWWF, 3 W's till 1979, was its own Northeast promotion for years. And they pretty much went from Maine. I think they probably stopped in Baltimore. Baltimore was like a shared area because the NWA, Jim Crockett Promotions, Mid-Atlantic, did stuff in Baltimore too. So Baltimore was like the shared city. And they would go upstate New York was WWWF, all through Pennsylvania, probably eastern Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And that was probably it. And they were fine with that. They made plenty of money. Obviously, great champions of the past, Bruno Sammartino, 8 years worth, Pedro Morales, superstar Billy Graham, into Bob Backlund. And then you get into the 80s. And Vince Jr., obviously the Vince we all know, was ready to take the reins. Vince's father, Vince Sr., had gotten cancer. So by 1982, 1983, Vince Sr. Signed off Titan Sports. I always liked the name Titan Sports. I wish he'd never gotten rid of it. I always liked Titan Sports. I always thought that was cool.
Agreed.
Titan Sports and the now World Wrestling Federation, the WIDE, was dropped in 1979 to Vince Jr. And then everything changed. Vince Sr. only had one condition. He had to keep three guys on the payroll. Well, two. I don't know if Pat Patterson technically counted. I think he was there anyway.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think it was just a Gorilla.
Yep. Gorilla Monsoon.
Grand Wizard? Was he the other one?
No, it was Arnie Skolin was the other one.
Oh, that's right, Arnie Skolin.
No, yep. Grand Wizard had died by then. Grand Wizard had passed away by then. No, that's it was right. Gorilla Monsoon. You're right on Gorilla Monsoon. Gorilla Monsoon and Golden Boy Arnie Skolin, who was at the time Bob Backlund's manager.
Yes.
They had to have jobs for life because they had owned part of the company,
mm-hmm.
Vince Sr. So Gorilla and Arnie pretty much were told, you got to sell your stock to my son.
Right.
I promise you will always have a job for life. And Arnie had a job, I think, until the early 90s, and obviously Gorilla had one for another, 13 years at that point. So.
Yeah, until he passed away in 1999.
1999, yeah, in essence. I mean, really, what was he? He was the president until, 90? How deep into 97 was he the WWF, the on-camera president? What was it, like mid-97?
Or was it by the... It was like August. Yeah, it was like August 97.
Okay. Because I know he was off-camera when he got shot, when he got beat up by Vader, and then Piper took over, and that was the whole Goldust thing. We're getting way far ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, let's get back on track here.
Yeah. Anyway, so Vince Jr. was ready to explode. You know, he wasn't happy with this. I'm not dealing with cards in Bangor, Maine, and Nashua, and, you know, all these kind of... That's nice. That's our bread and butter, but I want to take over the world. And in essence, he did that. And probably of all the promotions, he did probably... I will give Vern the benefit of the doubt. Of all the other promotions, AWA, Mid-Atlantic, Florida, Georgia, you know, Jim Barnett, Texas, all the promotions around the country, I think the AWA got ripped the most.
Yeah, pretty much.
He took everybody from Hulk Hogan, Mean Gene Okerlund, Bobby the Brain Heenan, Jesse Ventura, Adrian Adonis. I mean, he creamed that roster.
Mm-hmm.
And then the big moment happened, and he did something, Vince, right or wrong, depending on your point of view. Hulk Hogan, for those who don't know, everyone thinks he started in the WWF in 1984. Well, that's not true. Vince Sr. signed Hogan in 1979 as a heel, managed by Classy Freddie Blassie. And he was a heel for a couple of years. And he had some decent matches. He rough fought Andre at Shea Stadium. He wrestled Bob Backlund a couple times. But then, of course, came the infamous Thunderlips job. Of course, Vince Sr. found out that Hogan was asked by Sly Stallone to play Thunderlips in Rocky III. And Sly said, I want him in this movie. And Hogan told Vince Sr., I'm going to go make this movie. I'll be back in 2 weeks. And they're like, I'm not taking you off the road for 2 weeks. You're not doing it. And Hogan said, well, yeah, I am doing it. And Vince Sr. said, well, you're fired. So he did Thunderlips, and then he went to the AWA and became a superstar. And that's actually where the term – here's another little fun fact. That's where the term Hulkamania came from. I don't know who thought of it. I don't know if it was Hogan that came up with the word. Do you remember it in the AWA DVD?
I don't. I'm not sure who created it. But, yes, it was during that AWA period.
Yeah, I don't remember if Vern actually invented the word or if Hogan actually invented the word Hulkamania. That still remains to be seen. But the word was not invented by Vince. And then, of course, Hogan left in 1983 because he thought he was getting stiffed by Vern. And then Vern wanted his Japan money and all this other nonsense. By 1983, at the end of 83, Vince Jr. did not want the Bob Backlund-style champion that his father liked. So in came the Iron Sheik. And, of course, younger fans think the Iron Sheik is the crazy guy that's on the Howard Stern show. But let me tell you something. Iron Sheik was one of the greatest wrestlers of the 70s and 80s. And then January 23rd, 1984 came along. Hogan wins a title. And we're on our way. Here comes 1985. And here we are. Our first big show of what is, in my opinion, considered, and Justin's opinion, the modern pay-per-view era. And this is where it all began. So let us turn back the clock for you today, here in the place to be. Sit down, enjoy. There's some beers in the fridge. Nachos are coming. WrestleMania 1. Or just WrestleMania. A lot of people don't say 1. But it is WrestleMania 1. March 31st, 1985. From Madison Square Garden in New York City. Question for you. We were talking about this on the board some time ago. We had thrown around, if you remember, you had thrown this on the board on one of our threads, create a card and, take a modern pay-per-view brand or title that had never been invented. For instance, SummerSlam 87 or WrestleMania in 1984. And I had done a card and I did a WrestleMania in 84 and I had it at Yankee Stadium in late April. If Vince had decided, I want to pose this to you, and listen to this question. If you have an opinion about it, please email us. If Vince had decided to do this show outdoors, if he decided to do it at Yankee Stadium or Shea Stadium, would anything have changed in the whole scope of things from that point forward? If he didn't do it at Madison Square Garden, decided to do it outdoors or maybe too much, do you think anything would have changed from that point on?
I'm not sure. It probably depends on what the success of it would have been. Maybe doing something outdoors at that time of year still probably would have been pretty cold. I think they had to do it at Madison Square Garden. That was their home. They were running shows there every month. And really, in essence, no matter how much they talk about it during the show on commentary about, how this is the greatest card ever assembled and all this other stuff, it's basically just a house show. With some big matches tacked on the end. But for the most part, it's a glorified house show. And I don't know. I don't know if it would have really made a difference in the long run where it was. I think it had to be there, and I think it made sense. The build-up was there. the war to settle a score, you know, a couple months before or a month before was there. So I think it just made perfect sense that it had to be in MSG.
There was actually a show before the war to settle the score. We'll get to that in a second. There was a show in August of 84 called Something Else. And that was the reason that that date sticks in my head, or that show sticks in my head, is when Wendy Richter beat the Fabulous Moolah for the women's title, which was, of course, huge because they said that Moolah held the belt for 30-something years, which we all know didn't really happen. But and then February 18th of 1985, again, as Justin mentioned, about 6 weeks before this show, was the war to settle the score, and that was that crazy show. That was where Wendy Richter lost the title to Leilani Kai, and of course their rematch coming up here. And Hulk Hogan was facing Rowdy Roddy Piper for the World Heavyweight World Wrestling Federation Heavyweight Championship. And I'll tell you something, you want to talk about heat. That was crazy. I just watched it on one of our 24/7 tapes in our library. The crowd went friggin' crazy. They were going nuts. Cops were getting involved. I mean, it was nuts. I mean, you can tell that Vince was probably salivating, like, all right, I'm feeling good. I got something started here, because that was nuts. Mm-hmm. And we'll get to the main event when we get there. But the stage was set, and I'll tell you something. I remember renting this. This was like the second tape I ever rented before the Best of the WWF Volume 4. That was the first wrestling tape. That and PWI's Lords of the Ring. Do you remember the first tape you ever rented?
I think it was WrestleMania 5.
Was it?
Yeah, I think
was
so.
Was that a two tape?
No, 4 was the two tape. 4 and 5 I rented a lot when I first started watching in 1990. But I'm pretty sure 5 was the first one.
Yeah, the first one I ever rented was the Best of the WWF Volume 4. I think it had George Animal Steel on the front. Or Morocco. It was a heel. It was either George Animal Steel or Magnificent Morocco. I don't remember which one. And then the PWI Lords of the Ring, which was hosted by Gordon Solie. It actually had Flair, Harley from Starrcade 83, and it had a bunch of matches from the David Von Erich Memorial Show when Flair lost to Kerry at Texas Stadium, or the Cotton Bowl, I don't remember which one. And this was the third tape I ever rented, WrestleMania 1. It was not a pay-per-view. I know we say pay-per-view reviews, but remember the whole discussion we had? People mm-hmm. brought it up on our board. This is technically not a pay-per-view, although it did have – it was a pay-per-view in some areas.
Yes, but it wasn't national, just some markets. Mostly it was closed-circuit TV,
yep.
Which for those who aren't aware, that's where basically they'd air it throughout arenas throughout the country. You'd buy a ticket to go to the arena. You'd sit in the arena and watch it basically on the Jumbotron.
On a huge screen, yep. I actually, when we get to our next pay-per-view review podcast, will be the first closed-circuit I ever saw, which was WrestleMania 2. So that's where the bread and butter was there. I mean, 380,000 in closed-circuit attendance,
mm-hmm.
22,000 at the Garden, and the buy rate was 1.1, which doesn't seem like a lot, but considering they didn't have a lot of houses, 1.1 is actually pretty good.
Yeah, definitely. Yep.
Our announcers are a team that you and I think of quite fondly, and a lot of fans do, and that is, of course, Gorilla Monsoon and Jesse the Body Ventura. I don't know how long Jesse was an announcer at this point, a color guy.
Yeah, I don't think it had been too long. I think it was, we can look it up, maybe in 84 is when he came down with the blood clots in his lungs. He had to hang it up, and he still wrestled sporadically throughout then, and a little bit into 85. But by that point, he had basically transitioned to be the main color guy, and really it was a great move because, you know, he was flamboyant, but he really wasn't the best wrestler, and I don't think he would have been as well remembered if, he didn't make that transition. It looks like it was September 84 when his in-ring career ended, and he started announcing. He returned briefly in 85 for a few matches, but other than that, he was pretty much a commentator from that point on.
Yeah, I do remember him having a Intercontinental title match with Tito Santana early 86, late 85, early 86 at the Garden, on a Garden House show. I think it was early 86. It was like a month before Savage beat Tito in Boston. I think it was like January 86. It was just a one-shot thing, and he wrestled Tito for the Intercontinental title. It was mm-hmm. either December 85 or January 86. It was on one of our 24/7 tapes. And there's a lot of rumors that Gorilla was holding Jesse up during the stand-up at the Open.
I don't think that's even a rumor. I think Jesse's pretty much the one who confirmed that. that he was so nervous that Gorilla did have to support him up. And it is funny because if you listen to that show, and I just watched it recently, if you listen to the commentary, Jesse really hadn't gotten into that sarcastic, heel-based commentary for the most part. You know, he was pretty, at this show, he was pretty unbiased. Pretty much just called the action. He, you know, when, later years when you think of Jesse, you think of him as just someone who constantly argued with Vince and Gorilla and defended the heels and called out all the faces. And that's something here where he was doing a little bit, but it wasn't really in full effect yet.
Right. And he was using still using a lot of history. Mm-hmm. And he talked about guys' fathers, and we'll mention that in a couple of matches from now. He mentioned somebody's dad. But, you know, Gorilla had been doing some commentary. Gorilla had only been doing it really not that long either, maybe a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, I think he was, still was a little, not shaky, but Gorilla definitely helped him along at that point. But and I'll be honest with you, I'm glad because a lot of 84, Gorilla did commentary with Mean Gene on these house shows, and they were abysmal.
Because
you had two sugary baby faces, and they were just whining and whining and whining, and it was awful. So I am very happy that Jesse stepped in because – and again, you're right. In this instance, Jesse just kind of went with the flow. I think he just didn't want to – I think he was too nervous to screw up, so he probably just kind of went with the flow. By the time he got comfortable with it, even by November when he does the Wrestling Classic, he's in full heel mode and is the Jesse that we all know and love. So it didn't take him that long. But.
And speaking of Mean Gene, he sings the national anthem here, and I must say I think his version was even better than – Christina Aguilera's at this year's Super Bowl. He really wasn't that bad.
No, he wasn't.
Yeah, he did okay. Actually, but.
Yeah, we get some good. As we go through our the legacy of WrestleMania, there are a lot of good national anthems, and there's a lot of lousy national anthems. All right, let me ask you this then, Mr. Rosero. Who did a better national anthem, Christina Aguilera or Rockin' Robin?
We'll get to that when we get to WrestleMania 5.
Yeah, that's pretty awful. Anyway, all right, so let's get our opener. First match, no dark matches. And if there were, then we don't know about it. I don't think there was. First match is Tito Santana, who, overly popular at the time, against the Executioner, which at the, you know, back then was one of those usual generic masked guys. There were a lot of them back then. Mr. X, the Red Menace.
It's funny, too, because he was one of those guys that had bounced around randomly, and the funny thing is Gorilla and Jesse talk about how he says this particular Executioner is undefeated, and they were really kind of building him up as being an undefeated star. And of course, this particular Executioner was portrayed by Buddy Rose, who I believe this is actually his only pay-per-view appearance. You know, he was a guy who was big in Portland and then AWA, but he did some job duty in WWF until like 1990. This is his only pay-per-view appearance, though, and he's very svelte here compared to what he would become by the end of the decade.
Yeah, that's for sure. Tito Santana was one of Vince Sr.'s favorites, former tag team champion, and he had earlier in the in 1984 defeated the Magnificent Morocco to become the Intercontinental Champion, and then he lost it in August to someone. We'll tell you who that someone is in a little bit. So he was still on the chase to get his Intercontinental Championship back, and this was just a good opener, nothing fancy, but it was a good match to get the crowd hot.
Yeah, it was pretty basic, and we'll get into this a little bit later, but there is a spot I thought Tito would have been better suited for in the show, and something I really don't understand considering they were really building it up to be this mega show, but we'll get to that a little bit later. I'll save that for when we get to where I think he should have been. But, you know, the point gets across. He comes out, gets a win, gets the crowd going. Crowd loved him. You know, he puts out a fine match. So there's really no complaints other than I think maybe he could have been better utilized.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I if he wasn't going to be anywhere else, at least this was a good spot because, again, it's a popular guy. Crowd was hot in the beginning, and you want to get this crowd fired up quick. Because, as I said, you know, the quality of these matches are not great. But I don't think that was anything that Vince was worrying about at the time. I think he just wanted to have some success and make sure the crowd was hot. So, not a great, you know, an average match. I mean, we grade our matches, incidentally, folks, between 1 and 5 by halves. So it's, you know, 0.5, 1, 1.52, 2, all the way to 5. It's about a 2, maybe a 1.5. But, again, I think it was more just to have a popular guy to open the show and win and get the crowd hot. The next match was, you know, one of the this match is one of the early perfect examples of the term kayfabe. For those who don't know, obviously kayfabe means, you know, suspending disbelief and kind of suspending reality for the sake of fantasy for the product. The match was King Kong Bundy, who was a big, he's, you know, remember the condominium with legs from Atlantic City, New Jersey.
And he did look huge here when I was watching it. And, you know, they're really putting over his size and how immense he was. And he really looked just like massive. And he really did look like just a major threat. And, you know, they had him with Jimmy Hart here.
Mm-hmm.
And you could tell that they were definitely building him for something larger and that something would come a year later. But,
right.
You know, here he's just going against Special Delivery Jones, who was one of those guys, we call him Jobber to the Stars, where he, whenever he competed against guys lower than him, jobbers or other guys on his level, he'd pick up the win just to make him look like a threat. And then when he faced guys like Bundy or other, you know, higher guys on the food chain and house shows and TV, he'd generally lose. But it made those guys look like they were beating, you know, somebody capable.
Exactly. And he was one of the few guys that were able to get shots off on bigger guys, too. Bundy's, for the most part, Bundy really established himself down in world class with the Von Erichs down in Dallas. He was part of Devastation Incorporated. He was part of Skandor Akbar stable. So he was pretty – and it's funny. If you watch some of those older world class clips, whether on 24/7 or online, it was weird seeing Bundy with hair.
Mm-hmm.
He actually had hair in the early – late 70s, early 80s with Fritz and all those guys and the kids down in Dallas. Obviously, he obviously had no hair at this point. Shaved it. The reason I'm talking about suspending disbelief is, for those that remember, Bundy won this match in 9 seconds. And that was the big thing, 9 seconds. And that was like the record forever in WrestleMania history.
Yeah, they really play it up as soon as the match ends. You know, they were saying, oh, we got to wait for the official time. And then they confirm that it is a record. And, yeah, they do play up the 9 seconds, which I don't get why they really need to go that, you know, out of it. Because we have a clock at 24 seconds, and that's a pretty big discrepancy. And it was pretty obvious that it was more than 9 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, I think it took 9 seconds for SD to hit the corner and fall.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Then you still had the splash, and you still had the three count. And, yeah, it was definitely not 9 seconds. It was, Justin's correct, it was 24 seconds. But, again, another good example of getting someone over. I don't know if – here's another debatable point. I don't know if Bundy at the time – because I say this in our written review. I don't know if he at the time was grooming to be the main eventer for WrestleMania 2. Because I know at the time they were still talking to Nikita Koloff in Mid-Atlantic about coming in and being the next big Hogan heel. So I don't know. I think I do agree that I think they were pumping his character up, you know, big heel.
Yeah, I think they were just planning him for a big run and probably a title feud. Now, at this point, they probably didn't even know that there was going to be a WrestleMania 2 because they had to see how this one went first and if they were going to be able to pull off a second one. So
right.
I don't think they were saying, oh, a year from now we'll have a fight Hogan. But I do think he was obviously being built to be fed to Hogan at some point.
Yeah, and he looked awesome here. I mean, I agree with you. He was just a huge specimen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, everybody makes fun of him. Oh, he's a big fat guy. But you know what?
No, he could work. Yeah.
Large guys are fat. I mean, you know, what are you going to do, you know? But, again, it was nothing fancy, but a typical example just to pump up a good character. A lot of character building for this Mania. But Bundy wins it in 24 seconds. We're not going to try and fool you. Our next match, another guy coming in and getting a big push with a very good reputation beforehand, and that was Ricky Steamboat. And he took on Matt Bourne. And this is where we talk about things like history, which, you know, at the time, Vince didn't mind it as much. As he got bigger, he kind of dumped the history part, at least for a while. But I remember Jesse saying that Matt Bourne was the son of tough Tony Bourne. At the time, I didn't know who the hell Tony Bourne was. And I don't think I've ever actually seen a Tony Bourne match. But Matt Bourne, of course, would end up being a bigger character
mm-hmm.
7 years down the line. We'll get there when we get there. Ricky Steamboat obviously had a fine reputation coming in. He was the 1977 PWI Rookie of the Year. He was in Mid-Atlantic. He had won 9 championships in his 7 years in Mid-Atlantic. He obviously had a great feud with Ric Flair, which of course would be reignited later on in the decade. But he came in with a lot of high credentials. In fact, he's still wrestling in his NWA tights. He had his white tights on that he used to wear, and he didn't get into his martial arts gear till later on in the year and into early 86. Again, not a ridiculously bad match. Again, just a chance to, you know, give two guys a payday and kind of establish Steamboat as a, you know, popular character. And
yeah, because he had you know, he had just come in, like I said, so they were you know, really trying to get him you know, like you said, get him acclimated to the promotion, get him over with the fans. In a match like this, on a card like this, is just perfect for him to get this win. Matt Bourne, you know, concept professional, goes out there, puts him over. They have a solid match. Steamboat comes off the top, gets the win. So it was good stuff. No complaints there.
No, and obviously Steamboat would go on ahead to bigger things in his WWF tenure. By the way, don't feel uncomfortable when you're typing, sending us emails to say WWF. We're going to grandfather it in. So you don't have to say WWE, and we kind of go by the dividing line of what, April 2002.
Yeah, that's when it happened. It was after Backlash 02 is when they had the changeover. So we'll change it then if we get there.
Yeah, we'll change it then when we get there. But yeah. From here on, before then, we will do call it WWF, and you don't have to get upset, and we won't get sued. So nice, good win there for Ricky Steamboat. Takes out Matt Bourne. About a 4.5-minute match. Nothing offensive.
Yeah, no, solid work. And you know, coming off a really hot NWA run where he had a little feud with Flair, and then he had a good tag run with Jay Youngblood. So he had a, you know, big run in NWA, and then he jumps here, and he you know, becomes one of the major forces during the expansion here in the mid '80s.
Our next match is the only thing about this show that really pisses me off. Just because I think this was booked poorly in the sense that they could have really made this match hot if they had fixed it slightly. The match is Brutus Beefcake, new to the scene, good friends with Hulk Hogan behind the scenes, taking on a name that's, at least his last name, would be very familiar, and that is David Sammartino. Obviously, he is Bruno's son. Obviously, you know, there was probably some slight nepotism here as Bruno probably went to Vince and said, you might put my kid on.
Yeah, and at this point, I think they wanted to still keep Bruno around, keep him happy. You know, he was good. He was still way over with the fans, especially here in New York. He gets a big reaction. And, you know, I always hated this match, but watching it again recently, it actually wasn't as bad as I've always kind of dumped on it for being, mainly because the crowd is so into Bruno and Johnny V at ringside. And Gorilla and Jesse actually do a really nice job kind of telling the story of the match. It goes on a little too long. Instead of 11 minutes, maybe you put it at like 6 or 7 and give the rest of that over to Steamboat. But what I think they really should have done is just done the tag match. They should have had Bruno. They should have had, Bruno and David team up against Beefcake and Johnny V. And, you know, that way you get, you know, Bruno can kind of carry his son a little bit in the ring. He gets the hot tag, gets the win. You can feed Johnny V to him. Who cares if he gets the pin, gets pinned rather, and you keep Beefcake strong for his heel run. So I think that would have been the way to go. You get Bruno on pay-per-view. Instead, though, they kind of go with this mess of a singles match.
Yeah, there's no problem that this, you could have put this match, in fact, you can even have had this decision if you wanted to, at the war to settle the score. And then have Johnny V and Beefcake just beating on him, and then you have Bruno get in the ring, and the Garden would have gone absolutely bonkers. And then you put the tag match here, and at least you get Bruno on the card. And Bruno was still wrestling, you know, in and out. He actually wrestled a lot in 85, and even into 86, he was in the ring. So he was still in ring shape. And I don't think there was been any problem with making this a tag match and kind of helping these guys out a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because the match is just a complete mess. Crowd's good. Could have been better. I think they just realized that, and the ending just shit on them, to be honest with you.
And Bruno,
and again, 12 minutes for
And Bruno was.
I was just saying, 12 minutes for a double countout was just 12 minutes for a double countout was just silly. But
yeah, and Bruno was there, and he was still competing on house shows and stuff. So it just to me just doesn't make sense why you wouldn't use him. Unless they didn't want him to overshadow David, but whatever. I mean, you can still have David, you know, wrestle the majority of the match and even get the pin on Johnny V. It just a weird decision.
Yeah, and the unfortunate thing for his career is David would never get another chance. Essentially, again. He would hang around till what, July of the following year. He would go to the AWA. Then he would end up by 1990, because I taped these shows when they were on ESPN. He ended up going to Herb.
UWF.
Herb Abrams. UWF, which was a complete clusterfuck. You want to talk about a has-been group of misfits? Oh God, Ken Patera, Jimmy Valiant.
Orton. And, I think Orton was there, right?
Bob Orton. Yep, Cowboy Bob was there. Paul Orndorff was there. It was an absolute bunch of guys just screaming for a paycheck and could care less.
Mm-hmm.
And David was there for a while. And then, as we mentioned, the last time he was really on major camera was in December of 1996. He was on Nitro, and he took on Dean Malenko for the Cruiserweight title.
Yeah, talk about random cameos to pop up out of nowhere in 1996.
I'm surprised he didn't join the NWO. Everybody else did, but
it might have just been a tryout, maybe as a you know, show of good faith to Bruno or something, or even David, just saying, you know, we'll give you a tryout match, or here's a one shot. Maybe they needed a guy to lay down in wherever they were. So yeah, whatever. I mean, he in the end, he just becomes a footnote in WrestleMania history.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that his career went the way it did. But anyway,
all right. Well, the next match here. Go ahead.
Oh no, I was just saying, yeah, and it's unfortunate. And Beefcake would survive this and move on to better things.
Yes.
Good. Next match.
All right, yeah, next match. Now this is where I think Tito Santana should have gone. Our next match is the Junkyard Dog challenging Greg Valentine for the Intercontinental title. You know, JYD was very over. He was a big star. And I think he had a little bit of an issue going on with Valentine at this point. But the major feud was between Tito and Valentine, because Valentine had beaten Tito for the IC title. They had a feud going on, and Tito even comes out after the match here, because Valentine pins JYD with his feet on the ropes. Tito comes out and argues with the ref. The ref restarts the match, and JYD wins by countout. I don't get why you wouldn't have the Tito-Valentine IC title match here. That's a match that really could have carried this card and been the best in-ring match of the show. And you continue, you know, what is a pretty hot feud. And then you can even have JYD in the opener. You don't lose much crowd-wise because he was just as over as Tito. So you just put him over the executioner in the open to get the crowd going. So is this a weird choice why they didn't do the Tito feud here?
Yeah, and whether they were going to have Tito win it or win it back or not is irrelevant. It's, you know, it's not that big a deal.
No, they could have Valentine steal the win like he does here. And that, you know, that builds to a Tito rematch later in the year.
Yeah, exactly. Greg Valentine, incidentally, similar to Ricky Steamboat, an exceptional career in Mid-Atlantic. Obviously, Greg Valentine's got some pedigree. He is Johnny Valentine's son. For those that don't know, you might be a little too young. Even actually, I'm probably too young because I didn't watch him wrestle. Johnny Valentine was an exceptional wrestler in the 70s, late 60s into the 70s. A lot of people remember his name because he was the one that got paralyzed in that infamous plane crash in 1975 that included Ric Flair, you know, Mr. Wrestling 2, and Jesus, who else was on the plane? David Crockett.
I think that was it. I think it was just the four of them.
Yeah, and the pilot. Pilot was the only one that died.
Yes.
Yeah, the pilot was the only one that passed away. But Greg Valentine had an exceptional career in NWA. He was actually he was tag team champion with Flair. He was U.S. heavyweight champion, and also was part of probably, actually, and it was very recent at this point, it was almost only a year and a half before this, one of my favorite NWA matches of all time, and that was the Dog Collar match at Starrcade 83 against against the Hot Rod, Roddy Piper. I love that feud with his ear bleeding, Piper getting in, Valentine's punching him in the ear with a chain, and oh, it was awesome. Unbelievably violent. Very fun. Valentine debuted in 84, and he actually beat Tito Santana on September 24th, 1984 in London, Ontario. Tito had won the title that previous February, ending Don Morocco's 13-month reign as Intercontinental Champion. And then he held it till September, and then the Hammer beat him. JYD, also a very well-known performer up to this point. He wrestled in down in the South in Louisiana. I think he wrestled for Jerry Graham in Florida. He had wrestled for, ironically, and you wouldn't think this, but he actually wrestled for Stu Hart up in Stampede out in Calgary.
Mm-hmm.
He was all over the place. Actually, there's a very rare, if you have the Ladder Match DVD, and over these podcasts when we're reviewing these shows, we'll be referring, if you want to see these matches and you don't have the full WrestleMania tapes, we'll refer them to other DVDs that are out there that you can get. This match between JYD and a very young Jake the Snake Roberts is actually on the Ladder Match DVD. Very weird. The ladder looks like it was a painting ladder that came from a closet.
Yeah, it was very odd.
Yeah, very different than the myriad of Home Depot ladders that Vince would use over the last 10 years. But anyway, JYD superiorly, hugely over coming into this match. Great Valentine, great heel. The personalities were fine. I slightly disagree with you. I don't totally think Tito needed to be in this match. I don't mind him in the opener. And
I just don't get why they didn't do it, because the way they built the show was to make it the most, you know, the biggest card of the year. That seems like a match they'd have. But I guess at this point, the mentality was still use your TV and use your pay-per-view or closed circuit to really bring the fans to local house show. So probably their thinking was continue the Tito feud here by having him show up, you know, help JYD, screw Valentine, and then you go to the local arenas to see the Santana Valentine rematch. I guess that would be the only reason I could think of not to do it.
Exactly, that's what I think. And I think they, we would have another title match coming up next, which would really piss the fans off. So I think having JYD win this match without necessarily needing the belt was fine for them. And then Tito runs in and he tells the ref that Valentine used the ropes when he rolled up JYD, and very rarely it's weird how that happens sometimes. Some guys can I guess it's all the whole kayfabe thing. Sometimes they'll persuade the refs to reverse it, and other times they don't listen. In this case, for some reason, because it was Tito, they did listen,
yeah.
And Valentine got counted out.
Makes no sense. And yeah, Jesse, Jesse pretty much does that too.
Yeah, yeah. Where does a ref get off? Tito comes in, you have to just believe him. Or Chico, as Tito. Did he call him Chico here yet?
I don't remember. I just watched it too, and I'm not sure.
I don't know if he started calling him Chico yet. And, of course, he used to say that he owned a taco truck. It was very politically incorrect. Nobody cared. No. It was good. It was good television. So JYD wins. No, doesn't win the title. And Valentine and Santana continue their feud. And eventually, Tito would win the Intercontinental title back that July in a pretty good cage match in Baltimore. So another title match coming up next. This match, probably one of the major upsets in the history of WrestleMania. I don't think anybody expected this to happen. Your World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Champions, a very popular team,
mm-hmm.
the U.S. Express, which was a couple of guys based in the South, Mike Rotundo, who was a former Florida heavyweight champion, and Barry Windham, who obviously had a pedigree. His father was Blackjack Mulligan, who was a former tag team champion in the WWF in the 70s with as the Blackjacks, Blackjack Lanza. They had beaten, on January 21st, they had beaten Adrian Adonis and Dick Murdoch. Actually, a pretty good tag team
mm-hmm.
for the straps. Their opponents would be two guys who had been in the company for a while. The Iron Sheik, who actually, when he first was hired in the WWF in the late 70s, went by the name... oh, God, what was it? Kazro... It wasn't his real name. His real name's Kazro Vaziri, but it went by something. Oh, God.
I'll look it up.
What was his name?
God, I'll look it up. You can keep going.
Okay. Anyway, he had a... He went by a different name in the late 70s, and he obviously feuded with... He was the bad guy feuding with the baby face.
Yeah, great Hossein Arab.
The great Hossein, that's right. And he would, he would feud with Bob Backlund in the late 70s, and then he would vanish. I think he went to AWA. The other thing about Iron Sheik, that not many people know, Iron Sheik was in one of the most famous wrestling classes in history. He was trained by Vern Gagne in 19 73, I guess, 72. He was an Olympic wrestler for Iran in 1968. That's not, he says that, and that's not actually not a joke. That's the truth.
Yeah, in 72, he trained with the Vern Gagne and Billy Robinson in AWA.
Yeah, and his in that class was not just him, but that class also had Ken Patera. That class had Jumpin' Jim Brunzel. But, of course, the one guy in that class that obviously everybody knows was Ric Flair. So, and his tag team partner was another guy who was a big heel in the 70s based on real-life events, and that was Nikolai Volkoff, who was a big-time heel in the 70s and was a threat for world titles. He feuded with Pedro Morales, and he feuded with Bruno Sammartino in the 70s. He had black tights. He was I think the Grand Wizard was his manager.
Mm-hmm.
And what's funny is that he wasn't Russian.
Right.
He was not Russian. He's Polish. And he hated communism. So it was actually pretty funny that he was like the face of the Red Menace in the 80s, and the guy hated the Russians and he hated communism and he loved being in America. It's pretty funny. This match, I think a lot of people thought was a throwaway. The US Express were slated to get big rematches with Murdoch and Adonis in that summer. So this match a lot of people thought was kind of a throwaway. Well, guess what? How about that? Whack over the head with Freddie Blassie's cane, and we have our first big upset in the history of WrestleMania. The Iron Sheik, Nikolai Volkoff, are your new World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Champions.
Yeah, and I think I think the main reason here, because the title change doesn't make much sense, and honestly, it's short-lived. Rotundo and Windham would win it back in the summer. I think it was just to have a title change on the show. Obviously, they weren't going to take the belt off Valentine, and Hogan wasn't defending his title, so I think it was just to say, hey, this is a big-time show. You guys got to see a title change. It was an upset, so it's kind of a big story. So I think that was really the main reasoning behind having it.
And it would turn out to be a smart move for Vince and, well, eventually, Windham and Rotunda would win the titles back before the next pay-per-view, which would be the Wrestling Classic, and there wouldn't be a title match anyway at that show. But by the end of 85, they would lose the titles to another team. We'll tell you who that is when we do our next podcast. And these two guys both did the same thing to Vince, but in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
Both left to go back to Mid-Atlantic, to Jim Crockett Promotions, but both did it in very different ways. Barry Windham just got pissed off about something and left. He quit and went back to NWA.
Right.
Mike Rotunda wanted to go too, but he was not – Mike Rotunda was no dummy, and we've known throughout his career Mike Rotunda, not only is he a good wrestler, but he's a pretty smart, shrewd business guy. And he told Vince, well, I'm going to leave too, but I will, you know, finish out my house show obligations, do whatever you want. I'll lose to anybody you want. I'll team with anybody you want. And he actually would continue the U.S. Express with Danny Spivey.
Right. And yeah, and he does last for a little while longer. And, you know, he's on TV, was featured. Doesn't get a huge push, but, you know, he helps break Spivey in. And then he headed off to NWA where he'd really kind of catch fire and become, you know, a pretty big star before coming back to WWF in the early 90s. And like we mentioned in the review, maybe the way he left with Vince, the way he left off and you know, gave him his notice and didn't just bail, probably helped him because he would get a pretty good run when he returned.
Yep, and Barry Windham wouldn't.
True.
He'd come back two or three times. He would come back two or three times and get one piece of crap character after another. I know you have a soft spot for the Stalker, but
yeah, no, he never gets another, you know, solid push until he came back recently as an agent. They gave him a job, but you know, for a while, you could tell Vince definitely probably was upset with him because, you know, he was a guy that they were probably looking at as a major star. He had the look, young guy, you know, blonde hair, tall. He could wrestle. So I think if someone maybe they had in mind to give a big push to, you know, so they probably weren't very happy when he just up and left like that.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, girls loved him. I mean, our one of our fellow place-to-be correspondents you'll get to know very well, Dr. G, grew up in Florida. And Barry Windham wrestled for Eddie Graham down there. And the girls loved him, he said. In fact, Dr. G knew – he actually met Mike Rotunda and Barry Windham because one of his father's friends was actually a wrestler. in the Florida promotion. He'll explain this all when he makes his debut here on The Place to Be. He actually got to hold – when Mike Rotundo was the Florida heavyweight champion, he actually got to hold the belt. And Barry Windham was just loved by all the female fans. So he could have actually been a big boost for Vince, but he apparently got pissed off that they lost the titles again later on that summer, and he's like, you know, screw you, I'm leaving. And,
Well, this too came during a time when not a lot of guys were leaving WWF unless they got turfed, you know, by Vince. This is a time when a lot of guys are being brought in on big money deals.
Who would want to be turfed now? You know?
Yeah, I agree. So it was, you know, curious decision by Windham, and so he would have a, you know, a good run with Ric Flair in the NWA. So, you know, you can't say it really hurt him too much, but long term it probably did. But he's just one of those guys that when you really look at his career in the long run, and we'll get to him a little bit more when he comes back. But when you look at him in the long run, you know, one of those guys that probably didn't really fulfill the promise that he had as far as probably being a major star.
Exactly. So huge upset, and you know, big time, big heat missiles were the Iron Sheik and Nikolai Volkoff, but they walk out of the garden as your World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Champions. Speaking of huge characters and guys that were very much over with the crowd, this next match, probably two of my favorite guys of all time. Obviously, one of the most popular characters in the history of this business, regardless of. What promotion or where in the country and where in the world, and that is Andre the Giant. He wasn't called the boss for nothing, and he was pretty loyal to Vince. I mean, he bopped around. He was like a modern day Bruiser Brody. He would, you know, go from one promotion to the other, get big paychecks, but he was pretty loyal to Vince. I mean, he stayed both Vince's, senior and junior, because he was at the WWF for a lot, even through the late 70s up until pretty much when he retired in 1991. He was pretty much with Vince the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And his opponent here is actually one of my favorite heels of all time, believe it or not. He cut a good promo. He had a good look, and I don't think he was a terrible wrestler. And that's Big John Studd.
Yeah, no, he was fine in the ring for what they needed him to do. And really, the hook on this match is to me is that it's one of the few that actually has a feud or an angle heading into it. You know, most of the matches we've talked about so far seem to just kind of be put together for this show. You know, with maybe a little bit of brief build-up. But now the next three, what are considered really the big matches of the show, were the ones that had the heavy storylines heading in.
Yeah, exactly. And this one goes back to 84. Bobby the Brain. This is the first time we see one of our favorite characters of all time. And I actually saw his DVD tonight at Walmart. I didn't get it. And that's, of course, Bobby the Brain Heenan, who will be one of our favorites. I mean, it's Bobby. Mm-hmm. Can't really say a bad thing about him. Not at all. One of the guys who you know, left the AWA for the World Wrestling Federation. And really, if you think about it, I just want to detour for just briefly. Why would these guys have not wanted to leave? Like, I watched the Spectacular Legacy of the AWA DVD. And I think to myself, what could Vern and Greg Gagne really bitch about? Think about it. They weren't paying these guys much, clearly, because I think money was the one thing that they all bitched about when they were in the AWA.
Right.
How do you not look at the burgeoning WWF and forget the just salaries? I mean, think of all the merchandise and just who wouldn't want to leave? So as much as Vince can get blamed for a lot of our good friends consider you and I hideous Vince apologists, and we do stick up for Vince a lot, but you know, that's fine. You know, besides the fact that Vince, you know, picked these guys up, they're like, you know what, Vern, you're not paying me half of what I deserve. You know, and Bobby was one of the best heat-seeking managers of all time. He needed to be in the WWF. There's no doubt about it. So I just had to say that because, you know, I know Vern likes to go on a tirades, and I don't know if he does anymore, but, you know, about guys, you know, Vince stealing guys. But you know what? These guys all knew what they were doing. They looked over on the other side of the fence and saw, wow, a lot of money coming from that, and left on their own. So,
well, a big part of it, too, is that, you know, Vern was just really behind the times and didn't seem like he wanted to accept where the business was heading. And that was a big part of it, too. I think a lot of these guys maybe saw the writing on the wall and knew that Vince was either, you were either with him or against him. So a lot of these promotions, you know, like Stu Hart and like a couple other ones, saw it better off selling their promotion and delivering a few of their stars to Vince instead of having Vince just take them and put them out of business. And that was something that Vern fought to the bitter end. he didn't want to give in, but he also didn't really learn until it was almost too late.
Exactly. I mean, I would rather just, you know, to me, it's not losing. You know, if I owned a promotion and Vince wanted to buy it, where do I sign?
Right, exactly.
I mean, look, you're going to get a – because you know they're going to get a good piece of the pie, and Vince takes care of those who take care of him. And from that point on, the Hart family, and obviously we'll talk more about them as time goes on.
Mm-hmm.
They're not at this show, but any of them. But, you know, Stu was taken care of probably for the rest of his life at that point. And other promotions did the same thing. The Von Erichs did, although they signed with the Jarretts, and that's a different – a whole bowl of wax. But Vern, you know, was just very proud. And the reason we bring up Vern Gagne a lot is because there's a huge rumor that comes up at the end of this show,
mm-hmm.
that we'll let you know about. That's just mind-boggling. But anyway, back to Andre and Big John Studd. Two big stipulations in this match. It was a body slam match. One of the big things with Big John Studd was you couldn't slam him. He weighed 364 pounds. Big guy. Nobody could slam him. Andre, if he had slammed Studd, wins $15,000. And it was in one of those slick, and I wanted one at the time, blue and yellow WWF duffel bags. Always wanted one of those.
Little tote bag. Slick.
One of those tote bags. Loved it.
And of course, the other stipulation was if Andre lost the match, he was going to have to retire, which is often forgotten on the show because it's kind of a major storyline, and especially at a time like that when that stuff was believable because you didn't know if maybe he would be leaving for another territory.
Absolutely.
So it was, you know, was one of those stipulations that you could buy into, and it's often forgotten when you watch that match because they don't really they talk about it, but not as much as you'd expect them to.
No, and, you know, and Andre was one of those guys, I mean, of overly popular. Nobody wanted to see him leave. But, you know, he could have very well left. He could be gone. And, you know, again, the match is kind of short. I realize a lot of these matches are you know, sub 8 minutes. Only, I mean, the longest match in the show was the main event, which it had every right to be.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you had a lot of matches that probably could have had more time added on them if you didn't put 12 minutes to David Sammartino and Brutus Beefcake. But,
exactly. And of course, this match did come about due to one of the greatest real, you know, angle shot in the early 80s WWF era when Ken Patera and Studd knocked Andre out, shaved off the afro, and really, you know, put a lot of heat on them and on the feud. And so
yeah,
you know,
and I remember
Andre was, you know, pretty pissed off, obviously, at Bobby and his guys.
Yeah. I remember a lot of promos, him carrying around his hair in a little sandwich bag and, like, waving it at the camera. And, you know, I remember, you know, I was 11 years old. I'm like, damn, Andre, you need to defend your honor and get your hair back. And, you know, it was pretty stupid. But, you know, it was a pretty big angle. I mean, you know, Bobby's family. At this point, of course, Ken Patera was gone. We'll get more into that when he makes his pay-per-view debut in a few years after this. But he was gone. But, you know, Bobby had Studd, and he would eventually get King Kong Bundy from Jimmy Hart. But obviously, good guy always wins. That will always be the recurring theme about the mm-hmm. history of WrestleMania. The good guy always wins, at least the big guys. And Andre did slam Studd. And obviously, one of the luckiest group of people in the crowd, and we still have to decide whether it's real or not.
I think
Andre
it was.
Gets the duffel bag. It probably was. Andre gets the duffel bag, unzips it, just picks handfuls of money and throws it into the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
He probably threw like maybe three handfuls, and then Bobby, the little worm that he is, weasel, grabs a bag out of his hand and ran away. I wish I was one of those guys in the first three rows. Even if I got one $10 bill, I could say, hey, I was at the first. I would have framed it. There I was. First WrestleMania. There's my proof. $10. Probably had Bobby's face on it.
That would be pretty funny.
It would have been pretty good. So Andre the Giant, yes, avenges losing his hair and defeats Big John Studd and slams him.
Yep, and good match. I mean, well,
and the crowd's pretty hot.
Not a good in-ring match. Yeah, a hot match.
Now,
perfect for what it was. They were looking for, you know, the pageantry of the show. So I think it was definitely, you know, it was perfect for what they needed it to be. So the next match.
Yep.
Go ahead.
Yes. Well, this match, again, one of the feuds that had that big big pop, and this was one of the matches that really was the highlight of that War to Settle the Score show in February. The women's and I don't think the women's title would be this important again at WrestleMania for at least 15 years, probably.
Yeah, definitely, and maybe not ever, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, not at this high to the, at this high in the, and it would never be this high in the card either. But it wasn't necessarily the two wrestlers; it was the people surrounding this match that was boosting the product. Leilani Kai, who was the Fabulous Moolah's charge, taking on Wendi Richter for the women's championship. Wendi Richter was a little known, pretty good-looking wrestler from, and she was in Texas, and very popular, and she came to the WWF, and decides to, you know, become a popular star, and Vince jumps up immediately on her. Number one, she's good-looking, and two, she actually wasn't a bad wrestler.
No, not at all, not and for the time period.
And on July 23rd, 1984, that was July, my bad, July. I don't remember the name of the card. I'll have to look it up on Graham Cawthon's site. Moolah defended her title, and Wendi Richter shocked her, upset her. Moolah had, except for a few days here and there, Moolah had been the women's champion since 1956. Now, obviously, if you were listening to us earlier in the podcast, the WWF was not around in 1956, so this women's title, quote-unquote, bounced around from one part of the world to the other. So it wasn't really the WWF women's title, it was the women's title.
Yeah, it was kind of a mess. I mean, she would defend it and hold it, and there are a lot of rumors about Moolah, abusing her power and requesting favors from the women she trained and holding them down and having a lot of grudges. And I guess to be a major star for that long, she probably did do some unscrupulous things, but here she is here as, and I'm kind of surprised actually that they didn't just have her be the one in the match. I'm a little surprised they went with Leilani Kai, regardless of, you know, how old Moolah was, just based on name, I'm surprised they didn't use her. But of course, in Wendi Richter's corner was Cyndi Lauper, who was a major, major recording star at this time, and was a big part of the whole rock and wrestling connection they had going on. She had her video, The Girls Just Want to Have Fun, Captain Lou Albano, who had been a heel, but now recently turned face for this feud, was in that video, and was a big part of this, and they did the whole thing with David Wolf and Roddy Piper kicking Cyndi Lauper, so the whole, they had a lot going on during this period, specifically at the War to Settle the Scores, where a lot of the build took place for this, and that's where Leilani Kai, with Moolah's help, defeated Wendi Richter for the title. So that set up the match here, a month later, a little over a month later, and to be honest, after the main event, I think this might have been the hottest match on the card when you factor in the crowd. They were really, really into this match. And mainly, you got to think Cyndi Lauper was a major part of that.
I don't think there's any doubt. And the match itself really wasn't bad. And this is where Piper, and we'll get more into Piper in the next match. He was just, he might go down next to Hogan. He might go down as probably Vince's most important acquisition at the beginning of the modern pay-per-view era, because he was just an absolute heat magnet. You just, from this time, from 85 to late 86, you just wanted to punch him in the face. And obviously the big moment that got, that turned Captain Lou face was when he got a gold record from Cyndi Lauper. You mentioned Cyndi Lauper getting kicked.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was when Vince, when Piper came in the ring, technically, Lou is still a heel, so everyone's like, "Oh, Piper's going to come in. Him and Captain Lou are going to keep doing the, sexist jokes to Cyndi Lauper and all these people." And Piper grabs the gold record and he smashes Captain Lou over the head with it,
mm-hmm.
And the place just went off the wall. And the energy level would continue and lead up to the win by her by Wendi Richter for the title. Loses it to Leilani Kai at War to Settle the Score, and we get to this. And I think with I like when Cyndi Lauper calls her Lani Kai, Moolah, Lani Kai, Lani Kai, with the Queen's accent, Lani Kai.
And you got to give it to Cyndi Lauper because she really threw herself into this job, into this role. She was on a lot of house shows, and she really stuck around even after this as Richter's manager. She really did put a lot of effort at a time when she didn't really need to do something like this because she was such a major star. You're going to give her credit. She really, really worked hard to get this whole thing over.
Yeah, and on the other side of the coin, I remember seeing Wendi Richter was on MTV interviewing with the VJs, and obviously that spilled over to Piper and Hogan and all that, and we'll get to that match in a minute. But this match, really, if you go down to the, I mean, I don't want to, you know, I get very dramatic when I say a lot of things like this, but really, if you look at it from Brad, just call a spade here. This match might go down as one of the most important matches in the history of the company, because this really was the match. Yeah, the main event was the one that people went to, but this match really was the one that got the mainstream in their seats. And this is, I don't want to say this match sold out the Garden. I'm not going to go that far, but
it was a big part of it. It was definitely a big part of it. And it was a big part of the success at this point, due to the Rock of Wrestling stuff, being on MTV a lot, being in the mainstream. You know, I agree with you. This definitely was a major, major match and a major, major feud for the development of the company.
And obviously, I think it was most importantly, you know, good for the women's division, which would end up crapping out in a couple years anyway, and then come back. But Wendy Richter, Leilani Kai goes for the high cross body and a little, you know, the usual twist and turn, and Wendy hooks the leg and she wins the women's title for the second time. This would probably be about as high as Wendy Richter's career would go. Later that year, in November, we get the first, I guess you would call it the first screw job. 12 years before Montreal, Wendy Richter was having issues with a guaranteed deal with Vince, and instead she loses the title at a house show to a masked woman, the Spider Lady, which would end up being Moolah in a mask.
Mm-hmm.
Richter was pissed off, humiliated that she got, you know, stiffed like this, and we didn't see her on TV again until 2010, when she was inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame.
Yep, it's pretty crazy stuff. You know, you always think of the Bret Hart when you think of a screw job, but really, Wendy Richter was the first one. They wanted the title offer. She wouldn't sign that deal, and so they sent Moolah out to shoot on her, and that was that.
Yeah, and I don't know if they're still married. I think they are, but Wendy Richter is married to WWE Spanish announcer Hugo Savinovich. So,
I'm pretty sure they're still married. We can check it out right now. Actually, no, they're not. He was married to her. He's now has a new wife with two kids. So, they are no longer married, but they were for a while there.
Okay, we might have to change this on our. We have to change her last name on the. I'll have to do some. It's a good thing that we do this as well, because it gets to clean up the written files.
Yeah, I'm not sure if maybe she does still go by that name. It doesn't seem like it, though. It looks like she's just Wendy Richter, so.
Okay. So, Wendy Richter wins back her championship in a match that, again, might be one of the more important ones in the history of the company. You know, it got the crowd hot, and now they're ready.
Mm-hmm.
Because our main event, you want to talk about a hot crowd. Woo! This one took the cake.
Yeah, definitely. And just the, you know, pomp and circumstance surrounding the match. They have, you know, Liberace come out. He dances with the Rockettes. They have Billy Martin come out to do the ring announcing. Muhammad Ali comes out to be the guest referee on the outside. So you just had a real lot going on here. Pat Patterson is the in-ring referee because they wanted someone to help keep Mr. T under control. And this is where they just broke it all out. Everyone comes out. All the celebrities, there's just chaos around ringside. Just so many people around ringside. The crowd is insane. And, of course, the match is Hulk Hogan teaming up with Mr. T, who at the time was a major star in the A-Team, had coming up, you know, his appearance with Hogan in Rocky III. And they're fighting Roddy Piper and Paul Orndorff, both major, major heat magnets at this point. Both fairly new to the promotion, as in, you know, the year before. But they were just both major heels at this point. And some of the great stuff leading up to this was Hogan and Mr. T, their workout segments, the training segments, going supermarket shopping, working out, and preparing for the show. And, of course, the night before the show, they actually appeared and hosted Saturday Night Live, which is pretty major when you think about it. That's something that doesn't even happen. It only happened a couple times during Dirtiest Peak in the 2000s. So pretty crazy to think about that those two guys were on Saturday Night Live the night before the show. So a lot going on here, and it definitely was the first, you know, major pageantry of WrestleMania to cap off the show.
And it just – and it kept going and going. And you had three guys who just knew what to do in their roles. And you had Hogan, who was the world champion on top of the world. You had Piper, who, you know, in the whole scope of putting together good feuds in professional wrestling, you need a yin and you need a yang. And without a Roddy Piper, there may not have been a Hulk Hogan. But Piper knew exactly what to do. He was a snotty little prick.
Mm-hmm.
And Orndorff was this pompous, you know, chiseled superstar. Plus he had Ace Cowboy Bob Orton as his backup. Then you had Piper, and then you had Hogan, and you had, of course, another hot guy. Who, here's interesting. I wonder if he was hurt, because how do you not have Jimmy Snuka wrestling at this show? Why didn't you have Orton wrestle Snuka?
Yeah.
Actually, they wrestled. My bad. They actually wrestled at the War to Settle the Score, because that match is on one of the DVDs. I don't remember which one, but I think it's on the 80s DVD. But how do you not have – could have made this a six-man. The place would have gone even crazier. You know?
Yeah. I don't know if I would have done that, though. I think that would have been a little bit too much for what they were looking to do. I think Snuka – it is questionable why they didn't have him wrestle, but I think I'm okay with it. I think I'm okay with him being in the corner to balance out Orton, because Orton was going to be there no matter what, because he was Piper's backup, so you knew he was going to be, you know, involved there. So they needed someone to offset that, and probably maybe they wanted him involved too in case T had any issues or any, you know, brain farts or did anything wrong. Snuka could kind of maybe jump in and help balance things out. So I understand the reasoning for having him there.
And of course, there's a couple of urban legends with this match. Number one, apparently the day of the show, Mr. T vanished. Apparently he was bugging out, wasn't sure if he could do this. He was getting a little weird. And apparently he vanished on that Sunday. If I were Vince and Hogan, I would have been crapping myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Finally, Mr. T showed up and everything was fine.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about all the preparation they put into this match, all the build, if something happened and he bailed, that definitely would have been awful.
Yeah, that probably would have been the end. Because at the time, I don't know if Vince and those guys knew how to recover yet. Mm-hmm. The other thing, and we've mentioned him a lot on this show, even though he's not even in it and he's not even working for the company, and that's Vern Gagne. There is a rumor that Vern offered money to Bruiser Brody to jump through the crowd and slam a steel chair into Mr. T's leg and botch the whole thing. Whether that's true or not, I'm not sure. It wouldn't surprise me, though, because another story, which is confirmed by the Iron Sheik on the 80s DVD, is that during the Hogan Iron Sheik title match, January 23rd, 1984, Vern had offered Sheik money to injure him in that match, too.
Right.
So suddenly Gagne is turning into Vito Corleone.
Yep. And that's what things were back then. It was kind of that mob mentality where these guys had their territories, and if someone was trying to bust into them, and steal their guys, you know, they all were going to gang up and put an end to it. So I do, you know, of all the rumors out there, that's one I definitely would put some stock in.
But obviously it didn't happen, and the match went on. The match was hot. And this is the first big main event that obviously Gorilla and Jesse ever did as commentators, and they were spot on. Mm-hmm. I mean, it didn't take long for the two of them. There's no doubt about it. It didn't take long. And obviously their announcing would get better and better, and we'd have some peak moments, which of course we'll discuss right here on The Place to Be. What do you think of the schmoz at the end? I don't know if I ever really asked you this. What do you think of the whole schmoz at the end with Cowboy Bob jumping off the top rope, whacking Orndorff in the head with the cast, kind of a schmozzy end instead of making it clean? Do you think that hurt the match?
No, because I think there was so much chaos going on, and it's not like it was a real cheap finish. I mean, you know, Cowboy Bob was someone who was always getting involved. He comes off the top, he hits Orndorff. That gives them a reason to turn Orndorff face, which they were looking to do. So I'm fine with it. And there was just so much chaos. It just really builds to that, you know, just a really fun finish to the match. And I think that's what they were looking for at that point.
Okay. Well, all right. I thought, and fan, you know, email us what you think about that or anything about this show. placetobepodcast@gmail.com. And that's the end. Again, Orndorff, you know, this chaos. Perfect timing by Mr. T. Actually did hit one cue right in this match. Orndorff had Hogan tied up. Piper was about to hit him with something, or probably with a punch. Mr. T cuts him off. Perfect timing. Somebody like Mr. T could have totally blew that.
Mm-hmm.
And he cuts Mr. T. He cuts Piper off at the pass perfectly, and that sets up Hogan, who gets turned around by Orndorff. Orton on the top rope drops the cast. Hogan turns around, whacks Orndorff in the head with the cast, and gets the pin. Place goes bonkers, and Piper and Orton, like, you know, ditch Orndorff and leave.
Yep, and that pretty much set up his, you know, upcoming face turn, and then eventually we know where that goes, but we'll get there. So, you know, to cap the show off, this is one of those matches, again, wasn't great, but the excitement level and the brawling and the chaos really, you know, is bumping up, and it's really a fun match to watch. It's like clocks in at 13 minutes. It's not anything crazy, but the heat around it is just tremendous.
Exactly, and a good way to end the show. The crowd's going nuts, and it was fun. There's no doubt. So there you go. Place is going crazy. All the foam fingers are out. And there's an awesome promo at the end. At the end of the show before they go off. And Hogan's like, you know, Hulk Hogan, Mr. T. And Jimmy Superfly Snuka, we rule supreme, brother. Can you dig that? It was so un-Hogan-like. It had this, like, slick urban sound to it. It was very, very un-Hogan-like for, mm-hmm. for the time. But I always dug that promo at the end. I thought it was pretty cool. And I always liked and one thing we need to mention, I always obviously another legendary announcer in the history of WWE, and it's a shame he's not in the Hall of Fame yet, and that's Lord Alfred Hayes, who probably wasn't totally used to all this, you know, pomp and circumstance and all this hullabaloo. He's sitting there outside the entrance holding his little program, and he looked so uncomfortable it was probably entertaining.
Yes, definitely.
I think he looked like a deer in headlights half the time, that's what makes that show so fun to watch. It's just so unique because just all this weird, you know, all these people who never really, you know, they've been in the business a long time, but this is a very different kind of show for them. You know, you've been in big shows, but it's one thing to be, even if you're in a venue that's so big in terms of the stadium, you know, big venue with a big crowd. But TV's different because it's just so much bigger. Mm-hmm. You don't have to worry about promos and all that kind of crap because, you know, you're not filming anything. But this is huge. And it seemed like all these, you know, you could tell that all these legendary and all these experienced, you know, industry guys didn't quite know what to do yet. So, and the perfect example of that is all just the awkwardness of Lord Alfred on camera. It's just, mm-hmm. it's priceless. Absolutely priceless.
And something else, too, that was funny when I was watching this recently is, I don't know if Jesse Ventura was just getting a jump on spring training for baseball where everyone's in the best shape of their life, but I think literally every match, one of the guys in the match, according to Jesse or Gorilla, was in the best shape of their life, looked to be in the best shape of their life, looked to have put on 20 pounds, looked to have lost 20 pounds. Every single match, I know it was one of those things that, you know, announcers would do to, you know, to build the kayfabe part of it and, you know, add to it a little bit. But it was just really funny that basically every match they were saying that. So it's just something that something I noticed that made me laugh.
Yeah, they always, you know, that was like some of their crutches when they were first getting their announcing chops. That's pretty funny. And that goes along with the next 4 years when they would keep saying that it would take 20 minutes for Greg Valentine to get going in a match, even though half the time the matches were 7 minutes long. But anyway.
And I also like how everyone – the Gorilla was one of especially – you know, he talked like 15 to 20 pounds was nothing. Like, you know, he looks like he's put on 15 pounds since the last time I saw him. Like, you know, that's a lot of muscle or fat either way. So, I mean, you know, they'd say he dropped 20 pounds. You know, he must have just saw him a week ago. So it's kind of – it's funny. I mean, stuff like that at the time, you just kind of, you know, went with it because – the backstories and the stories like that were just expected, and it was part of the charm of the you know, product. But it is funny to hear them talk in those terms.
Yeah, it is pretty funny. So there you have it, the very first one, WrestleMania 1. And if you look at the column on our board, on our message board, you probably look at it and go, A+? What kind of crack you guys smoking? But again, read it. Understand. This is the granddaddy. It doesn't. You're not grading it as if it's a house show. If you're just grading the show itself, it's probably like a C.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a C minus. And that might be generous. But you know what? And Justin, you made a perfect description of it. Just all that chaos in the main event with Ali and Billy Martin and the Rockettes and friggin' Liberace and his Crystal Bell and all that, you know, just all this chaos and all this electricity. That's what makes this show great. Not the matches. The matches are crap.
Right. Yep.
That's irrelevant. Nobody cares. It's about the characters. And these are the kind of shows that pissed off all these other promotions that thought it's all about work rate. It's all about wrestling. It's all about the matches. You got these guys like Bundy. Who the hell wants to watch Bundy? Fat guys who can't do anything, you know? And that's where guys like Vern Gagne just lost track of time.
Mm-hmm.
Because fans want to be entertained. And Mick Foley says it in the AWA DVD. He admits it. He goes, you know what? Some of those AWA matches were just hard to watch. Now, mind you, you know, having to listen to Roger Kent or what was the other lousy announcer for AWA? Not Larry Nelson, another hump, the other old guy. I can't think of his name.
Trongard?
He sometimes helped Vince.
Ron Trongard? Yeah.
Ron Trongard, yeah. Some of those guys are just – they're just abysmal. I'm sorry. Lord James Bleers. Like, these guys are just hideous. And they don't help they don't help these matches, those AWA matches at all. So they just didn't get it. You know, Mid-Atlantic sort of got it. Mid-Atlantic's problem was they didn't have the payroll. They didn't have the budget to do what Vince wanted. But I credit the Crockett's for at least trying.
Mm-hmm.
They just didn't have the money.
Yeah, and
but all
I mean,
other promotions just bitched and moaned and bitched and moaned, and it just got tiresome. And this show is a perfect example of how you get something off the ground.
And part of it, too, is just at the time, there was plenty of room for these different kind of products. NWA was more focused on blood feuds and in-ring action, and WWF was more pageantry and larger-than-life characters, and they didn't really care as much about the in-ring stuff. And even the guys that were great professional wrestlers, like a Piper, like an Orndorff, they were serviceable in the ring. They didn't wrestle great matches, which is fine. That's not what they had to be. So to me, you know, you can go either way. Both have their positives, both have their negatives. And I think, you know, at least at the time, you had that option to choose, which is something that's severely lacking now. You know, that option of choice. You only have that one major product. Back then, if, you know, you liked in-ring style, you liked the bloody feuds or the wars, you went to the NWA. If you liked the circus atmosphere, the over-the-top characters, larger than life, you know, you'd look at WWF. So it was a little bit of something for everyone.
Exactly. And this is a show that, no, is this a show you could throw in all the time and go, I can't, I really feel like watching the first WrestleMania. Probably not. It's obviously not WrestleMania 3, and you know, we'll get there, and you know, we'll get to that point, and that show, to me, will always be one of the most perfect shows. But this show is fun to throw in once in a while, just because, A, the train wreck situations with just trying to deal with television, and just the pomp and circumstance, just all these characters, and all these celebrities, and, you know, Muhammad Ali, guys, fans, Muhammad Ali.
Mm-hmm. He's almost a forgotten part of this show.
You know, he is an icon of sports life. And he was at the first WrestleMania. Wrap your head around that. That's amazing. You know, he could have looked at this and said, what the hell is this crap? No, because remember, he knew, you know, he wrestled. He had that weird thing with Antonio Inoki. And, you know, he dealt with that. He knew. No one understood pageantry and circus atmosphere like Muhammad Ali.
Mm-hmm.
He ate this stuff up. He loved it. Right up his alley. Liberace, yeah, he didn't care. Give him a paycheck. He can ring his bell and have the Rockettes and his little satin jacket, and, you know, and all these guys. And but, you know, Billy Martin at the time, you know, I don't think he was manager, though, was he? I'm trying to think. March 85?
I no, think he was just he getting fired. Yeah, I'm pretty sure
no,
he wasn't.
No, that was because 85, no, because 85, just crossing the streams to sports for a minute, wasn't, I think that was the year that Yogi was the manager for like 12 games and then George fired him.
I think so.
So he might have
yeah.
just Yeah, so he was on the verge of about to replace Yogi as Yankee manager. Like,
yeah, I'm pretty sure Gorilla even says former manager of the Yankees. Yeah. I don't think he says current, so.
Yeah, no, so I don't think he became the manager till like, early May.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyway, but just, again, though, just all these characters, and, you know, this show really needs to go down as the granddaddy, and if you want to watch it and go, wow, these matches are all so bad, then you're not really getting the point. And I'm not uncomfortable in saying that. If you're one of those guys who, you know, has to look at the work rate of the match, then maybe this product wasn't meant for you. Maybe, like Justin said, you are a fan of the way the Crockett's do things and the way that that the Von Erichs did things and the way that, you know, that Vern did things, and that's fine. But don't think you're gonna, you know, you have to look at the work rate product and go, oh my God, this Bruno or this San Martino, you know, beefcake match is very bad. And, you know, and it needs to be no stars. And, you know, you're not Bruno who? Nobody cares about him. And the Garden crowd didn't even care about that. They just wanted to see their heroes win and the villains lose. That's all they cared about. All right. They're not going there looking for a Flair Harley Race catch as catch can 45-minute match. They didn't want that stuff. The Garden crowds don't care about that. They like booing the bad guys and cheering the good guys. That's how Garden crowds are. It's how Boston is. It's how Providence is. It's how Hartford was. That's how it was back in the Northeast. That's how they were molded to think, and that's how it was. And that's what makes the show great, because you're looking at more than just the matches. So all this pageantry, I really wish. Again, I was only – you were four. You were four, and I was only I was 11. I would love to have been there that day, because, I mean, just to feel the electricity in that arena when you're such a little, you know, schmuck, you know, and didn't really understand anything, you know. It was just so special. So, you know, you take this show for what it's worth, you know. What are your final thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree with you. You take it for what it's worth. It's one of those things you it's almost like a pilot episode of a show, something to get the show off the ground, something to establish it as a major feat. And Vince has said many times, if the show failed and bombed, then he might not have made it another year. But the fact that it was a major success led to, you know, further success. And it's just really a snapshot of how big they were at the time with the mainstream and the rock and wrestling and all that stuff. So you have to give it an A+ just based on the historical significance. But as a card itself, you know, it's not that great outside of the crowd heat and those couple big matches on top.
Exactly. Well, there you have it. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. Why don't we switch things up this time around? Why don't you take us out?
Take us out. Sounds good. Well,
the basement door in the man cave.
Sounds good. We'll head out for now. Hopefully you've enjoyed our first few episodes here, our general headlines and our MLB recap and our first pay-per-view recap here. So we'll be coming back at you soon. Our next pay-per-view will be WrestleMania 2. We'll get to that. And we also have some fun interviews coming up. So check us out. You can visit us at placetobe@podbean.com. You can email us at placetobepodcast@gmail.com. And we also just created a Facebook group that we can get you the link to as well. So if you hit us up via email, we'll send you that if you want to come on there and post as well. So we got a lot going on. Keep checking us out, and thanks for listening.